Today is Wednesday. It's June 15th, 2022, and it is 2:39 in the afternoon. That used to be real critical. Actually, it still kind of is, because stuff happens while we're recording the Mincing Rascals podcast. Hi, I'm John Williams, and yeah, this is the Mincing Rascals, portions of which are broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8. And you can listen to me live every day on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Austin Berg, the blue-shirted panelist from the Illinois Policy Institute. Yeah, ask me why my shirt's blue, John. It's because it's my only clean shirt.
Are we that predictable? Eric's not here today. Playing the part of Eric Zorn is Austin Berg. Okay, let's not talk about blue shirts. This won't be a revelation to anyone, but sometimes negative advertising works. In the run-up to primary day, downstate Senator Darren Bailey has been blistering presumptive frontrunner Richard Irvin, the mayor of Aurora, with negative ads. And the National Democratic Committee has even been running ads supporting Bailey's cause. You can't turn on the radio or TV in Chicagoland and not hear one of those ads saying Irvin's a Democrat in sheep's clothing, and he supports Black Lives Matter. Another poll is out right now, and the Trafalgar Group says among likely Republican voters, 38% would vote for Darren Bailey. 20% would vote for Richard Irvin. 16% say they're not sure. Bailey is the guy Democrats want on the top of the Republican ticket. Austin, are they going to regret that? Are they going to rue the day?
Good question. You could see other states, we talked about this a few weeks ago, where that plan has certainly backfired. But the conventional wisdom is, yes, J.B. Pritzker would much prefer to face Darren Bailey in a general election. And by all the polling we've seen so far, the ads both that Pritzker and the Democratic Governors Association are paying for to call Darren Bailey, quote, too conservative, which, of course, is just saying Darren Bailey's a real conservative. It helps Darren Bailey. And also the ads they've put out recently on Richard Irvin's sort of support for the governor during COVID and at other points in his administration have definitely had an effect. And I think the Irvin campaign has had a really tough time with their primary strategy, which was that they were going to come into the race and basically make sure that no one was able to get over 30% of the vote. So drive Darren Bailey's favorables into the toilet, drive Jesse Sullivan's favorables into the toilet. I'm sure if anyone lives in the Chicagoland area and still receives mail, they have received mail from the Irvin campaign saying that both seeing Darren Bailey and Jesse Sullivan in a wide array of costumes and photoshopped, they were baseball players on the same team as Obama. They were sheep. They were all manner of things. And I think that was a bit of a miscalculation on that campaign's part, especially with Bailey. What they did was took someone, really the only person with any kind of a base in the race, which was Darren Bailey, because of kind of him coming out really hard on against the COVID-19 lockdowns with Pritzker. He was able to build a pretty substantial following with that. And then you see in your mail someone calling this person a Democrat who hates Trump. It's just kind of like, don't believe your lying eyes. I don't think that was really a believable message in terms of Bailey's record. If I was running that campaign, I probably would have focused all the attention on his record as a school board member, hiking property taxes as a member of that school board. That's something that's defensible, that people perhaps don't know about, mm-hmm. that is believable in some sense, mm-hmm. and would reduce his trust in Bailey. But it's really been astounding to see that much money be spent and really not been able to move the needle for Irvin or against Bailey in any material way.
Yeah, I think the number is still $50 million that Ken Griffin has given him. He's probably raised a little more on the side, but not that the Bailey campaign, right, Heather, doesn't have about $20 million behind it, too, between Dick Uihlein and some others. A lot of money has come his way as well.
He has. It's really sort of the battle of the right-wing billionaires, with Ken Griffin lining up behind Richard Irvin and Dick Uihlein lining up behind Bailey. I tend to think that anything is possible 2 weeks before election day, and I definitely don't have a crystal ball. But I think that the question this race has all the central question of this race for me, if it came down to Bailey versus Irvin, which I think it appears to have done, is whether there is a way for a Republican in any state, Illinois, Pennsylvania, is there a path to statewide office for somebody who is not willing to fully embrace former President Donald Trump and parrot his election denying lies? And I think that if Bailey is the GOP nominee, I think that that will fundamentally answer that question. Because if Richard Irvin, with $50 million, could not present himself as a moderate, not pro, but not anti-Trump option for GOP voters in Illinois, I think that's a pretty definitive answer to that question.
I wonder if they will regret, though, not unleashing him a little bit. He's so cautious, so scripted, so tied, it seems like, to his donor. For all the money spent for and against him, I don't really know this guy that well.
I don't think you're wrong. And I don't think it's a mistake that the first and so far only gaggle, and I guess I should define that, is when reporters crowd around a candidate or official and sort of ask questions and he answers them, took place after that sort of shock WBEZ Sun-Times poll that showed him losing quite significantly to Bailey. He has not responded to our invitations from WTTW to come on Chicago Tonight. He's certainly not responded to questions that directly that I've posed to his campaign.
Really? They don't even answer an email to you to stuff?
Well, his campaign does, but if I've got a question, say, hey, I'd sure love to talk to the candidate, they're not making him available. Until it was clear that that strategy of sort of trying to avoid reporters as much as possible began to backfire. A couple weeks ago, he first met the press and then was very, very scripted in the, that's what J.B. Pritzker wants you to ask.
Right. Yeah. How'd that work out for him?
Yeah, not great, I think, actually.
But I mean, so when was he last on? When was Richard Irvin last on Chicago Tonight?
Not since he was a candidate for governor.
Really? And he hasn't come on my radio show. I think he was on with one of our shows once. So that was a brief little get to know you, but it wasn't the sort of thing that we need. I wonder if getting close to the finish line here, Austin, they're going to say, all right, what do we got to lose? Let's let this guy talk.
Maybe. I think, though, it's a little too late for that. And the reality is that the reason you do that is to be able to, define the candidate a little bit more. And I think that that happened with Irvin had a very difficult record to defend in a Republican primary.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the reality of his campaign. I mean, he was on the record saying he strongly supports Black Lives Matter less than 2 years ago. That is going to be a really tough sell, no matter who you are, no matter what your personal story is, in any Republican primary.
Even as a Black person.
In any state in the country. The way that you can kind of overcome that is kind of addressing that forthrightly when people ask you about it and say, yeah, here's what I meant by that. Or, here's what my position was as a mayor of Illinois. I needed to deliver for my cities, and I really supported Governor Pritzker at first. But, as the pandemic went on, man, it really changed my mind. And kind of telling that story would have been helpful. But the combination of having that record and then obviously having Governor Pritzker and Darren Bailey's backers spending a lot of money on negative ads, highlighting those things, has made for a pretty toxic.
There are few ads running against him, Richard Irvin, that don't remind us that he strongly and passionately supports Black Lives Matter. Whenever I hear that, I think what they're really saying is, hey, this guy supports blacks. Black Lives Matter is a flawed political organization or activist organization. And I can understand why some people might take issue with some of their rhetoric. Maybe that's all they're trying to get across. But I think it's a bit of a dog whistle, too. Am I reading too much into that?
I don't think you are. I mean, I think it's clear that Black Lives Matter has sort of a toxic connotation for Republican voters. And I think that is complicated by the fact that Irvin is Black and that he tries to sort of thread that a little bit, at least in his initial ads, by saying all lives matter and sort of saying, well, yes, of course. I'm not walking away from that. but making it more broadly, and of course, All Lives Matter is a dog whistle in and of itself. I think it's important to remember that his campaign started in a bumpy way. You know, his first ad mischaracterized his response to the unrest and protests after the police murder of George Floyd. He mischaracterized how Lori Lightfoot, the Chicago mayor, responded to those protests, and then sort of doubled down on those. I'm not accusing him of lying or anything, but he was clearly happy to sort of focus on the facts that he thought sort of fit his narrative. That's problematic when you're relying on a strategy of where you don't talk directly to the voters, because then other people talk for you and it becomes really problematic.
In Aurora, for example, I mean, the ad writes itself, like there were police cars burning in Aurora. There was serious property damage in Aurora in the wake of the George Floyd protests. So I think in the context of a Republican primary, when you have someone saying they strongly and passionately support this group, and you have that next to footage of, wow, these protests got really out of hand in Aurora, this mayor was not keeping his city safe because he was equivocating with this group and strongly and passionately supporting it. So, of course, there are some parts of the Republican base that will see that more as, you know, something beyond just the organization of Black Lives Matter and what it is. But I do think, even setting that aside, it's just a really hard needle to thread.
And I think it's worth pointing out that for at least this moment, Darren Bailey is the front runner in the GOP race for governor, and that he's somebody who has said that the 2020 election was fraudulent and has at least implied that he would consider not certifying Illinois' electoral college votes in the 2024 election. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of has not been focused on by the media, because I think Darren Bailey hasn't gotten the scrutiny that comes with being the front runner in this kind of primary, statewide primary. And I will be interested to see whether my colleagues who cover state politics more directly than I do begin to focus on that. I think those are really important issues that, mm-hmm. honestly, it sounds like I'm being hyperbolic, but I promise you that I'm not, that truly the fate of American democracy rests on.
That sounds hyperbolic.
It's not, though. It's not. It's factual. You know me well enough to know that I don't engage in hyperbole, especially if and when Bailey wins that GOP nomination.
So this is a good, interesting point. Like, the Youngkin was able to win by saying he would have voted to certify. He was on the record saying that. He still won the Republican primary. He still won in the general in Virginia. Now, the problem really in Illinois is, you had, there could have been a path potentially for someone like that to run a little bit more to the moderate edge of Darren Bailey. And I think in retrospect, some folks might be thinking Richard Irvin on paper was the perfect candidate to win beat J.B. Pritzker, but unfortunately is too far to the left on some key Republican issues that Bailey became the alternative, you know, rather than Irvin. I think it would be easy to say, well, you know, there's no path to winning Illinois unless you're a super pro-Trump Republican. But I think given the options of Irvin and Bailey, we don't know what someone in between those two, you know, with significant funding.
See, I sort of disagree, because I think Irvin tried very hard to sort of follow that Youngkin path, right?
His messaging did, but his record was not that. I don't think that was believable to a lot of people. So,
his rhetoric, you mean? Yeah.
His rhetoric, which was very much, you know, all lives matter in the first ad, law and order, did not match his record that his opponents were very eager to point out.
Yeah, I wonder if Youngkin had an easier time sort of threading that needle, pulling off that high wire act, because he's a white wealthy dude and Richard Irvin is, you know, a Black man who does not have sort of an Ivy League pedigree the way that Glenn Youngkin does. Because Irvin's image is so different than Youngkin, whether he wasn't hobbled from the very beginning, because you look at Youngkin and you see country club Republicans. right? You don't look at Arvin and see Country Club Republican, which meant that he sort of was going to have a harder time, even under the best of circumstances, in combating not prejudice or sort of, you know, racism, but just sort of convincing Republicans that he was one of them because he's Black.
Bailey came on our show and I asked him if he would, if he won the primary, back off on his description of Chicago as a hellhole. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I said, well, I get a little defensive because I don't think it is. And he said, well, you've got a crime problem there and, you know, we need somebody. And I said, what's the governor going to do about the crime problem in Illinois, just as for instance, or in Chicago? He said, well, he sort of did that Saturday Night Live. Well, then we're going to fix it.
But how do we go about fixing it specifically?
Take it one step at a time. Identify the problem. Fix it. Identify another problem. Fix it. Repeat as necessary until it's all fixed.
You know, every problem that he articulated, if he's governor, he's going to fix it without really having many specifics on a plan. These guys are great at pointing out the problems, but sometimes they're a little thin on the solutions, particularly when it isn't really in their purview. I'm still going to be amazed. I won't be amazed if Bailey wins the primary, but I would be amazed if he beats J.B. Pritzker. It just doesn't. I mean, this is the guy who wouldn't wear a mask on the legislative floor at a time when we were in true crisis mode about COVID-19. He had to be dragged out of there. And yeah, he may not certify an election that he doesn't approve of.
To the hellhole point, I'm curious what you guys both think about the fact that, so Darren Bailey also co-sponsored the bill that would make Chicago a separate state.
Yeah.
So like the guy's very clearly like, Chicago should be a separate state, right? It's not the most pro-Chicago guy. And he called it a hellhole. The conventional wisdom is that a Republican candidate for statewide office needs to win like 20% of the Chicago kind of area vote to be competitive. Are there 20% of people in Chicago who would also describe Chicago as a hellhole for Darren Bailey?
Oh, sure. But I mean, keep asking questions, though. You're not done yet, right?
That's kind of my point, is that in my initial reaction to that is, oh, that guy's lost Chicago. Because he's describing Chicago that way.
Okay,
but then
maybe.
I realized,
yeah,
oh,
right.
There is like a fairly significant share of,
I'll bet it's more than 20%.
My neighbors might say that.
But yeah. Isn't the next question then, what are you going to do about it? And he's like,
yeah,
I don't know. I just got to the state house. I don't even know where the bathroom is.
It's a big question. His governance, he's been in the super minority pretty much his entire tenure in the legislature. So you've not seen in Illinois thus far with someone like a Darren Bailey making big calls.
You know, it's also interesting, though, that the surveys that we're talking about, I mean, this whole conversation is predicated on the latest survey, which says that 37% of the people who say they would vote, let's see, I've got a couple of surveys here. Is it 38? 38% of the people who say they would vote in the Republican primary say they would vote for Darren Bailey. And I asked him, okay, but that's people that would vote in the Republican primary, 62% of them say they won't vote for you. He just kind of chuckled the way he does downstate and then said, you know, the glass is definitely half full. Second or third place on all of these surveys is I don't know. So I wonder if the I don't knows are going to either go to Richard Ervin.
So I will share with you how I use polls to guide my reporting. And I do not look at the sort of the specific numbers. I think polls, because the margin of error can be so large, especially when you're trying to poll a subsection of voters in an off-year election held at a weird time.
But it's 2-1, Heather. It's 2-1, though.
Sure. So what I think you can do is you can look at multiple polls and you can judge the trend lines, right? Because at one point, Ervin was leading. And then the question becomes, well, are the candidates taking visible steps to reflect the showings of those polls? And you can look at Richard Ervin's decision to pull ads from downstate Illinois and to concentrate on the Chicago metro area as evidence that, if nothing else, his campaign believes that trajectory.
One important thing I think about that Trafalgar poll, and I think there were two other polls before that showing a gap of over 10 points, let's call it, between Bailey and the next person, is that the playbook now, if you're a Republican running for statewide office to get Trump's endorsement, is to prove with a poll, often from Trafalgar, that you are running away with the race, because Trump is not going to come in oftentimes unless he thinks this guy's going to win or this gal's going to win. So I think it's very interesting also that this came out about a week away, where Trump is scheduled to speak downstate alongside Mary Miller. If you're the Bailey campaign, you are hoping, you know, you get a vociferous Trump endorsement at that event. Now, there's only a few days left before the actual election when that happens. That might do more for Trump than for Bailey, just in the sense of, like, who are the people who aren't convinced yet to vote for Bailey on the basis of whether Trump supports him or not. I don't know if that's that big of a thing, but I would expect that poll to be used to go straight to the Trump camp and say, hey, get behind this guy.
Mary Miller is the downstate congresswoman who said
on January 6th at one of the rallies, she said,
this is the battle. Hitler was right on one thing. He said, whoever has the youth has the future. Our children are being propagandized.
That Hitler had a point. She, after several days, had to apologize for that. But, you know, I think it should be relatively clear that you never have to hand it to Hitler. I mean, I don't know.
One last thing about this, guys, and that is I'm on my radio show tomorrow, Friday, talk to the executive director of the Minnesota Ranked Choice Association, or whatever the organization is called. And I'm really interested in that as a concept. It is kind of interesting when the second most votes go to in a poll, say, undecided. You wonder who is the second or third choice for people. Because ranked choice voting, in trying to distill the will of the people, says, okay, you got 37% of the vote. That might win, right? Because it's more than everybody else. But two-thirds of the people are saying, we don't want you. So maybe you really shouldn't win, even though you have the most votes. And ranked choice then keeps recounting the votes, cutting off the last place person with each subsequent count until someone gets to 51%, 50% plus one. I wonder who would win then. I wonder if we had ranked choice voting in the Republican primary, as they do in Alaska right now, where Sarah Palin is running for Congress. Some states use this for their constitutional officers. I kind of like the idea of ranked choice voting. A, you got to educate people what it is, and B, you got to convince them that it's right. You know, should we do what I just described, or should say no? Whoever gets the most votes wins. 37 is the winner. I don't think that's the right way to go.
Well, when I was the City Hall reporter for the Oakland Tribune, Oakland instituted a ranked choice voting system, and it was designed, one, to encourage candidates not to engage in negative campaigning.
Sure, yeah.
And the idea is that if you want to be somebody's number two choice, you don't disparage their number one choice, and that it saves municipalities and states money. So, for example, had Chicago had ranked choice voting in the 2019 mayoral election, we would not have had two rounds of voting. We would have had one round of voting, and we would have known relatively soon after the February election whether it was going to be Lori Lightfoot or Tony Preckwinkle. But we don't. We have the top two vote getters in the nonpartisan election going to a runoff in April. I certainly don't know what's going to happen in the 2023 mayoral election, although everybody certainly seems to think that it will once again go to a runoff for the third straight election. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of trouble. If we have this technology so people could say 1, 2, 3 and go on with their lives, why not do that to encourage more people to vote, especially in states like Illinois, where people can vote by mail permanently. And that means that they can fill out the ballot in the comfort of their own home and then return it at their leisure to say, I've researched these candidates and this is my choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have it in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I know, because when I lived there, Cambridge had it. And then I think Alaska has it, as you said, and Maine, I think, has it in some races. I think it's a really interesting idea. Andrew Yang, I remember, is a huge fan of ranked choice voting. It's sort of like the new, like, it's a very popular centrist position to hold now, and it's been gaining more steam. And I think it's really interesting to test. I think in Illinois, it would be really cool to see it, see some cities adopt it and see how it goes. And then I think the next big electoral change beyond that, which is, I know in D.C. right now, there's a huge push to do this, by mostly led by a guy, Bradley Tusk, who, funny enough, was the deputy governor under Blagojevich when he was like 26 or 27 years old, maybe a little older than that. Crazy story. He has a good book called The Fixer about that. He's been trying to get mobile voting. So being able to securely vote from your phone in order to increase turnout. In both of these cases, you're looking at a problem of primary elections, incredibly low turnout. Chicago's municipal big elections, not even a primary, those elections, incredibly low turnout. What are ways to make it safe but easier to vote and more meaningful to vote?
I don't know if I'm
both are interesting.
I don't know if I like the idea of VWD. That would be voting while driving. I think if you're stuck in traffic, you go ahead and vote. Do we like that idea, Austin? Is that a beautiful thing?
It could be. I think more access to being able to vote is good, and it can be done safely. We do so much stuff that is very sensitive online now, and asking people to do, you know, whether it's vote by mail or actually go to a polling place on an election day, it just doesn't comport with so much of the other stuff that we do in our life. Like, when's the last time you've really needed to go to a post office to ship something or really needed to go to a retail store to buy something? It seems to comport more with how people behave now. So
Donald Trump on Tuesday had a pretty good day, although a lot of the candidates that he endorsed were running unopposed or were the prohibitive favorites. Do you guys have a scorecard for President Trump's influence, and what did we learn this week?
My scorecard, I've been thinking about sort of how he would be gaming out his next, you know, 2 years, essentially a year and a half ahead of the next presidential election. And if I'm Trump, you should signal to everyone that you're running, and you should not deny that you're running until it is absolutely necessary to do so. Because when you do that, and he recognizes he has a large amount of sway with the Republican base, he puts himself in a position to, if he doesn't run, really have the deciding choice in who sort of the establishment gets behind in the Republican primary for president. So I expect he will continue to back candidates who have shown that they have a very good chance of winning, so that his record will stand up and he can keep saying he has this big influence, which is probably true. Right up until he has to declare whether or not he's going to be in the presidential. So I think he will play in these elections. He will continue to right up until that point.
I imagine he's going to run, don't you?
Yeah, I also think that there are reporting requirements and sort of legal things that trigger once he declares because of, you know, just the reporting and that sort of thing. So I think that his staff has made it very clear that it serves him to put it off until after the midterms to make that announcement, just in terms of sort of like the legal requirements for. But I sort of see what the January 6th committee is doing entirely separate from the 2022 midterms and the 2024 presidential elections. And there are certainly points of connection because Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson, you know, the co-chairs, have made it very clear that they're making an argument that Donald Trump was responsible for what happened on January 6th and that it was a concerted attempt to overturn the election. And you know, we heard them say that the president was engaged in a coup. It's impossible to sort of game out sort of what the committee hearings will what impact they will have on the midterms or on the 2024 elections. And in some respects, I don't think it matters. I think what matters is that there's a record of what happened and there's some attempt to get to the bottom of what happened and to have sort of a reliable historical record.
You know, it does make me wonder, though, to what end? Renato Mariotti, the former federal prosecutor, he was the assistant attorney for the Northern Illinois District, said to us on the radio this week that based on what he had seen so far, it was after 2 days, mind you, of hearings, but I think we kind of know what's going to be discussed if we don't know all the details. Anyway, he said he would not bring federal charges against the former president, that Trump has lied or is unhinged or is unliked to many people. Doesn't mean that the Fed can bring a case and win. And they don't like to bring cases they can't win. He said something like, you know why we win 96% of our cases? Because we know we can win 96% of our cases. And those that might be difficult to win are less likely to to get a hearing. But he also doesn't like the idea of the current administration pressing criminal charges against the previous president. That is also a divisive thing, and it might not be worth the risk. 2 days in, any revelations, any sound bites? I thought Bill Barr's testimony, of course, was very interesting. I was amused, but not surprised, but kind of glad to hear the references to Rudy Giuliani's inebriation, since that had been widely and well reported. It's kind of fantastical to hear the stories about Rudy Giuliani in these January 6th, the meetings between the election and January 6th, just like killing the room with whatever they were trying to do, and that Giuliani was the voice that Trump kept hearing, who was reaffirming what the president wanted to hear, whereas all of the other people, former campaign manager, legal counsel, his own attorney general, were saying, dude, there's nothing here for you.
Everything that's been presented comports with the narrative that we now know well, which seems to be backed up by the facts that Trump was lobbying the Department of Justice and Pence to help him overturn the presidential election. And I don't think there's anything that's been presented that wildly throws that off track, obviously. I think having a measured, comprehensive record of what happened is important for the historical record, for jogging and for basically jogging our memories for how bad this was and how differently things could have gone if Trump had been surrounded by slightly less defiant people. And I think that that will be something we continue to see, these stories of these smaller acts of defiance in his wake or not, is good to have for the historical record. And I think we'll continue to see examples of that, but nothing huge, bombshell.
Oh, I disagree. I mean, I think it was a bombshell to hear that they have testimony that Trump suggested that those looking to hang Mike Pence, quote, should have, you know, have the right idea and he deserves it. I mean, I followed this stuff as closely as anybody I know, and I gasped out loud. And I think that to hear a sitting member of the United House of Representatives say that the former president engaged in a coup, you know, I don't know how that's not a bombshell. That bombshellness is muted because we've had so much reporting about sort of what went down, and there's been, you know, detailed information. But I don't think that we should be blasé about the fact that a sitting president suggested that an angry mob of his supporters should murder the vice president because he was unwilling.
You're shocked to hear that as an angry, defiant quip, Donald Trump said that?
No, I'm shocked to hear him say to sort of, I don't think it's a quip. I don't know his emotional state or anything, but for him to suggest that while president of the United States in the White House, I think it should truly shock us all. And I think, as Austin said, it should remind us that that day was really bad. And in some ways it was significantly worse than it appeared initially after. And it has only grown worse since then. And that if it's not a bombshell, I don't know how bombshells work anymore.
Well, I was intrigued by the meeting in the parking deck between the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. And the head of the Proud Boys, it was interesting to me that they spent as much time talking about Proud Boys the first 2 days. And the leader of the Proud Boys did meet with the president prior to.
The leader of the Proud Boys was at the White House in the days leading up to the January 6th insurrection, but he was banned from D.C. on the day of the insurrection itself. And while he implied he was at the White House to meet with President Trump, there's no evidence that the two actually.
Okay, so when they were in that parking deck, the smoking gun would have been a transcript of or audio of the president talking to these people saying, okay, here's the plan. But we just don't have that, do we? We don't have any. We do not have that.
But we have Donald Trump during the debate saying, stand back and stand by.
That wasn't a private conversation.
No. And that the Proud Boy organization and the Oath Keepers took that as a direct order.
Yeah, what was the president's intent when he said that? Was that just a poor choice of words, or was he saying, you're my guys and I'll tell you when to unleash your attack?
They went to D.C. assuming that, you know, sort of on because they thought that the president was going to declare the Insurrection Act. And I think the future hearings coming up this week and next week are going to focus very closely on sort of the machinations inside the White House for the, to, you know, to sort of pressure the president.
My worry, my bet is that there will be no conclusive proof that there is a verbal or other kind of contract between the president and these crazy people to do what they did. His lobbying things out at debates or tweeting things are just public fulminations. I don't know that you have evidence that it was as conspiratorial as we'd like to think.
I think maybe you're overthinking it a little bit, because if I'm trying to overturn an election and I speak approvingly about a group that is also interested in overturning the election, I don't know why there has to be some sort of, I am asking you to do crimes for me statement from the president. I think that certainly circumstantial, but that's, you know, evidence that would seem clear to me to sort of be able to draw a direct line.
The thing about hanging Mike Pence thing, the way that I read that, and Heather, maybe you're looking at something that I haven't seen, is that you essentially have, and this is so crazy to just like talk about in retrospect, by the way, and I don't mean to say it cavalierly, but you have these crazy people chanting hang Mike Pence, right? And that's happening at the Capitol. And then you have someone saying that they have testimony from someone who said that Trump expressed support of that sentiment. That to me is a little bit different than the president saying hang Mike Pence.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
I think that's what you're saying, John, right?
Yeah, I don't disagree. Like, obviously that's different, but I also think that, keep in mind that the time that the president is reported to have said this, the Capitol was under attack. Right?
Like, well, to have said, who knows what express support means. Now, of course, like what he did in this situation, I'm sure was incredibly disturbing. But I think if someone saying, it's almost like if you're at a sporting event and someone is saying some horrible thing at the other team and you're like, ha, yeah, they are a bunch of suckers. Maybe it was, I could totally see that happening. And I think in terms of,
there was
it's a little bit
there
of a difference
a gallows
in scale
erected on Capitol Hill. There was a working gallows erected on Capitol Hill.
No one was going to get hung by that thing. Nobody's neck was going to go in that noose.
Are you sure?
Yeah, as sure as I saw it, I don't think those people didn't even bring guns. Essentially,
that's
that was not a gun armed mob. There were some. There was a bomb planted. We still don't know about that. But I mean, it's amazing to me that there was not more gunfire at that sort of thing.
The possession of guns is banned in the Capitol, and it's banned in Washington D.C. So the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers staged their weapons at hotels outside the District of Columbia, waiting for the president to declare the Insurrection Act to implement that so that they could bring the guns in quickly. They had quick reaction forces.
Let me ask you this. Suppose the president is convicted of charges and he's a felon. He still gets to run for president. He could still be the president. Listen, I think this is important. And I think we're all kind of on the same team here about our understanding of who Donald Trump is. I wonder if a conviction would keep the Trump supporters from voting for him, or the members of Congress from still asking for his support and endorsement.
There's no possibility that Donald Trump is convicted before the 2024 election. I mean, keep in mind, the best example I can tell is Ed Burke, who was, you know, charged with
yeah,
the crime,
that's a good point.
You know, more than 3 years ago at this point, and has yet to face a jury. And, you know, if you think Ed Burke has unlimited resources to delay a trial, that, of course, has nothing compared to what Donald Trump would
$250
have.
$250 million. Right. Holy cow. There's your bombshell. Austin, you have 9 minutes before you have to check out, 7 minutes according to my clock now. And I want you to talk with us briefly, just get us started on the story, the Caterpillar Inc. Are they still a Fortune 30 company? The mega tractor maker from downstate Illinois, from Peoria, now headquartered in Deerfield, is now going to be headquartered in Texas. You want to say I told you so, Austin?
I don't want to say I told you so. I just want to say they told us so. So they're ranked 73rd. I just looked up.
They were Fortune 30 one time. Yeah, keep
going. Yeah, I mean, they were. They certainly slipped. But they have been one of the greatest corporate success stories in the history of our state. They've been here for nearly 100 years. And yesterday, their executives announced that they were moving their corporate headquarters from Deerfield, Illinois, down to Texas. And this, we talked about the Illinois Policy Institute many years ago, that Doug Oberhelman, the then CEO of Caterpillar Inc., in 2012, sent a letter to many of the leaders of our state and wrote a op-ed in the State Journal Register in Springfield, sounding the alarm and saying, our company is not investing in Illinois anymore. We could be investing a lot more here. We are not doing this to disparage the state in any way. We're doing this as a sincere sort of alarm that us and many other companies are questioning our future in Illinois. And the two main reasons for CAT were, one, a persistently out of balance state budget that offered no relief to taxpayers. That budget today is still consistently out of balance. The governor often falsely and publicly claims that he has balanced the budget, while in his own bond offering documents says that Illinois has a persistent structural deficit and that it is not balanced. And of course, our tax burden has only continued to go up, especially the property tax burden over the last 10 years since this letter was written. That was number one that needed to be fixed. And number two was the state's incredibly high workers' comp costs. So the costs for a large people-based business in Illinois for insurance on workers' comp is much, much higher than every surrounding state and much higher than most states in Illinois. And that's really a vestige of Michael Madigan and many other leaders in the Illinois Democratic Party and some in the Republican Party being completely beholden to the trial bar and passing legislation that was extremely friendly to that industry on the backs of many, many business owners in the state. So those two things were talked about a decade ago by the head of Caterpillar. And a decade later, Caterpillar is pulling out these, I believe it's 240 folks that actually work at that office. But it's a much bigger signal than just those 240 people.
Well, but they haven't said they're going to shutter Morton or East Peoria. They're not going to close the plants.
True. But that was what was so frustrating about the governor's statement. And I think Senator Durbin and Duckworth and Sherry Bustos released a joint statement as well. And they were very quick to point out, well, this is only, you know, a X percentage of the workforce of Caterpillar in Illinois. And guess what? If you have the corporate global headquarters of a business in your state, much more likely they're going to invest in your state. Much more likely new plants are coming to your state. If they've left, there's a reason for that, and it's that your state is not hospitable to their business. And of course, it's not going to be overnight. Caterpillar lifts up, you know, tons and tons and tons of equipment and plops it into another state. That's very hard to do.
Yeah.
But it's about their future decision making and not wanting to invest in the state and preferring to go to a state like Texas.
Is this the same thing as Boeing?
Boeing, I think, is a little bit different just because CAT has Boeing doesn't have as much manufacturing in Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say it's exactly the same. And CAT also is different just in the case that they were public about what they needed from the state government to have a successful business here. And it was roundly ignored for a decade.
Austin, why don't you tap out now then? Thanks for being on the Rascals today. And I just want to talk city politics with Heather for another minute. Heather, you got another minute for me?
I sure do.
Laura Washington wrote in the Chicago Tribune this week that, and Laura's going to join the Mincing Rascals podcast in the near future. I offered her the very same attractive terms that I've offered to the rest of you. And she said, take an hour and a half out of my week for no pay, I'm in. So Laura wrote in the Chicago Tribune this week that Lori Lightfoot has several black opponents. Community activist Jamal Green is now a candidate too. Washington said, to remain politically viable, the mayor needs a potent black vote. Her first task in the uphill journey to keep her job is to shore up what should be her natural base. One week into the official rollout of her campaign, she pointed out that Lori then went immediately to three black neighborhoods. Is that where this battle is going to be fought?
That's what Lightfoot thinks it will be. This is sort of a very sort of traditional analysis of Chicago politics, that a black candidate can't win without the support of black Chicago. That might be true. I just don't know that it is as cut and dry as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago because of the changing nature of Chicago's population. So Chicago is essentially a city divided in thirds by race. It's one third white, one third Latino, and one third Black. And I think that's very different than the racial makeup of the city in 2010 or 2000 or 1990. And I think that Lightfoot won 75% of the vote in 2019 by running up the vote, not only on the South side, but also winning just every side of the city. She won every ward. And if you ask her or her campaign team, she would say that she's not sort of limited to just competing for Black votes in a way that I think Harold Washington's campaign felt like they had to run up the vote on the South and the West sides to counteract white voters who would never have voted for a Black candidate. I don't know that equation quite works out the same way, but I think it's a question that a lot of people ask me a lot. Who is Lori Lightfoot's base? You know, who are her reliable voters and who does she need to make sure that they, you know, get out to vote? And I don't know the answer to that question. Part of that is because she won such an overwhelming victory in 2019 after basically coming from behind and nowhere. The other thing is that she's had such a difficult 3 years in office that there are a lot of different parts of the city that are frustrated with her leadership, which means that she's got to sort of compete on all accounts.
Well, with that many candidates in there, and if they're all cutting up the pie, she would still get enough of the pie. She'd still have the biggest piece, I would imagine, just no 75% of the pie.
Yeah.
So you're looking at a runoff.
Yeah.
I wonder if any of these candidates have the sort of name recognition or chops to beat her in a one-on-one, even though she doesn't start out with 50% of the vote. I don't know that anybody else is going to get 51% either.
Yeah, that's why it was so interesting to me that when Representative Mike Quigley announced that he wasn't going to run for mayor, at the same time he put out a poll saying that had he faced her in a runoff, he would have beaten her by 10 percentage points. And, you know, it's rare for politicians to trumpet hypothetical victories, especially against members of their own party. But it was
when they're not going to run.
When they're not going to run. But it was truly a shot across the bow, and it was, and many people saw it as sort of an invitation to other people. Hey, I can't run. I don't want to run. Maybe you do. And if you do, you can beat her because I could have beaten her. Mm. And I think a lot of people think she's beatable, but I also think that in some ways her power as an incumbent and her sort of inherent sort of advantages are being somewhat dismissed because there are so many people sort of lining up to take her on. And we in Chicago, this is still relatively new for us, right? I mean, we had 25 years, you know, nearly 20 years of Richard J. Daley basically running unopposed for mayor. We had another 20 years of Richard M. Daley running essentially unopposed for mayor. And then we had two terms of Rahm, and then he drops out of sort of the mayor's race. So in a real sense, Chicago is still trying to figure out what it means to have contested elections for its mayor every 4 years.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe that's why we don't have the answers. You don't have the answers to some of these simple questions because, well, we've never had this before.
That's right.
What was the ethics reform story? And then I'll let you go.
Well, so Alderman Michelle Smith, who was Lori Lightfoot's handpicked chair for the newly created Ethics and Government Oversight Committee, put together a really big package of ethics reforms, which would do a significant number of things, but probably most prominently would increase the potential fines for violations from $5,000 to $20,000. Now, when this package was unveiled in April, I think a lot of people expected this to be immediately championed by the mayor, who ran in 2019 as a reformer, who ran as somebody determined to clean up corruption.
These would be fines imposed on whom? The members of the city council?
Elected officials.
Elected officials, right. Yeah. Pardon me.
So so that when the mayor not only didn't endorse the proposal, but actually stopped it from advancing to a committee hearing, I think it surprised a lot of people. And it's still not clear, I think, to me or other people, what the mayor's problem with the package is. Now, she says it's not that she's against it. She's just not really sure what's in it. But it was really a stunning rebuke by the mayor against one of her own committee chairs to sort of stop it from advancing through the normal city council process. And it really, it seemed like this was going to be an opportunity for the mayor to say, look, I am a reformer. I fulfilled my campaign promises. Let's keep going. And that's not what happened. And in doing so, she really sort of, you know, put one of her closest allies on the city council in a really awkward position, and so awkward, in fact, that Alderman Smith asked Mayor Lightfoot, did you do this because I voted against the casino? And that, you know, that's old school politics, right? If you're going to get sort of tit for tat like that. And I think it just raises a lot of questions that we're going to be hearing more about the mayor's temperament and sort of her ability to work with people on the city councils and keep her friends rather than turning them into enemies.
Maybe the reason she did that was because she cares so much for the people in the city. I know I'm imperfect, but I'm a human and I just love you so much. This is what I do.
And of course, she sees a lot of this criticism as unreasonable, that she sees much of this criticism of her temperament as motivated by racism and sexism and homophobia. And I think that it is just going to be a truly interesting campaign as she tries to campaign as the toughest candidate in the race when she was elected, as sort of a breath of fresh air for Chicago that had ostensibly tired of autocratic mayors. Yeah. And now she's saying, well, but I'm tough enough to do the job. It's truly fascinating.
Well, is there another explanation potentially in your mind other than payback for not supporting her casino?
Oh, sure. I don't know that it was payback for casino, but it is, I think, another indication that the mayor oftentimes can pick fights that don't have any upside.
Really.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, Michelle Smith, I think, was really caught off guard by this, because for a committee chair to introduce a piece of legislation that would be covered by her committee and to have that blocked from advancing, you know, that's just it violates the norms of civility in the city council. And I think that's why so many people were like,
right. Especially since what was proposed wasn't a game changer. It was something in place already. We're just going to increase the amount. That sounds kind of administrative to me. That's not worth fighting.
There's also other changes in there. It would expand the number of companies that would face campaign finance contribution limits. So if you've got a contract with CPS, now you're not limited into what you can give city officials every year. This would impose limits on what you can give, and other changes like that. It would also increase sort of the rules against nepotism in hiring at City Hall. And, you know, and it's really designed to sort of close up any of those loopholes that were left in the ethics ordinance. And, you know, I feel like a broken record when I say this, but there are two members of the city council at this moment who are under indictment, federal indictment. And we just had one council member tossed off the city council because he was convicted of federal crime. So it's not as if corruption is still very much an issue at City Hall, but after COVID and after sort of the surge in crime, the mayor's shown very little interest in sort of directly addressing that.
Always a pleasure to visit with you, Heather. Austin was here and had to tap out just a minute ago. We'll raise another gaggle next week, and thanks for helping us out.
I was glad to be here.
That's Heather Sharone. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman and Ben Anderson. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Ta-da. All right.
That was fun.
Yeah, you did, as always, a very helpful and informative job.
Yeah.
By the way, I was just going to ask you, are you reading anything lately? What do you have your nose in?
Oh, I've been reading British Murder Mysteries.
Oh, really? That's your go-to?
Yeah, that's my go-to.
You've got time for that?
I do. It's very calming.
You must be off my brain. What's the British murder mystery you're reading?
So it is the Magpie Murders and the Moonstone Murders. Yeah. Both are very good. It's by the same guy who created the Midsummer Murders show on PBS. So it's very relaxing because they're all British.
And it's dignified, I'm sure, as murders
yes.
go. Very
yes.
much so.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.